From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Here we are, working on a holiday. All of you out there listening, you're probably off work, right? Enjoying a drink, maybe some savory barbecue. Well, perhaps not. Many of us carry around digital leashes to the office, smartphones, iPads, Kindles, that sort of thing. And as NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, those devices mean you are always tethered to work.
For Dimitar Popov, a business consultant from Chicago, the day off from work is dead. Time of death? As soon as he hears this.
I took off work, but with the promise that I would be periodically checking emails.
And returning phone calls and text messages from coworkers on his day off. He's spending it in an upscale hotel in Washington, D.C., where he's volunteering at a conference about his home country, Macedonia. But in between the panels and networking events, it's back to work in front of the laptop.
At any point in any day, weekend, weekday, you're expected to return phone calls, return emails, and there's really no shut-off point.
Popov says in his line of work, he always has to stay connected, even when he's far away from the office.
I mean, I feel it's a good thing for my boss, and I guess it's a good thing for me in the sense that I have to meet certain deadlines.
This is a concept that I refer to as blackberries on the beach.
That's Tony Onsidi. He's a lawyer in Los Angeles who specializes in labor and employment law.
It's a shorthand reference to the fact that employees today can sort of log on and be productive from just about any location on Earth.
There may be some places left to get off the grid, the middle of the ocean or on a mountaintop. But those quiet places are disappearing. In an age of smartphones, remote access, and now video calling, the space-age world of the Jetsons doesn't seem so far off. Remember those video phones George Jetson's boss would use to check in on his employees?
Jetson! Caught you again! Now stop goofing off on my time!
Your time! Yes, sir! Yes, sir!
The time employees spend out of the office on mobile devices for work has become a concern for some employers. Last year, a Chicago police sergeant filed a lawsuit against the city of Chicago. He claims the city owes him overtime for all the time he spent on his BlackBerry for work while off duty. The case is still in court. Tony Onsidi says the Fair Labor Standards Act has strict rules on overtime for American workers who are paid by the hour.
Even if the employee has not been specifically asked to answer emails after hours on a device or by remote access avenue, but the employer permits the employee to do so, then the employer owes that employee that overtime.
Even if that's time spent texting from the beach. That BlackBerries on the Beach concept Onsidi referred to earlier, it's something Lisa Regan, who's in sales, says she knows too well.
I have a BlackBerry in the bag, my cell phone over here, a separate one, and a computer back at the townhouse.
Regan's spending the weekend on a beach in Delaware. How does she feel about staying so connected with work?
I hate it. I'd rather it not happen, but with my field, other people might need my help, so I don't mind, I guess.
For some employees, though, there's still an option to go offline for the weekend. Brian Nelson brought his iPhone to the beach, but...
I haven't looked at my email in 3 days, which I'm sort of happy about. It's going to hit me when I get home.
That's right. He'll be checking his work email from home. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
As part of our childbirth series, Beginnings, we're going to consider a parental dilemma that predates the big day. We're talking about the brain-racking, anxiety-producing, gotta-get-it-right task for parents-to-be that's settling on a name for a newborn. The popular TV comedy Friends captured the drama in that decision. On the show, Phoebe proposes that Ross and Rachel have the option to veto 5 baby names each. Rachel makes the first suggestion.
If it's a girl, Rain.
Veto.
Why?
Rain? Hi, my name is Rain. I have my own kiln, and my dress is made out of wheat.
Well, from there, things start to get a little out of hand.
How about Dayton?
Veto. Stewart.
Veto. Sawyer.
Veto. Helen.
Vito.
Is it me, or is Vito starting to sound really good?
Well, we called up Laura Wattenberg. She fancies herself a bit of a baby name wizard. In fact, that's the name of her website. She's got a popular blog, and she's written a book also called The Baby Name Wizard, a magical method for finding the perfect name for your baby. And she says it's hard for parents to find just the right name because the way children are named has changed.
For centuries, English speakers chose the same names generation after generation. You had your Johns and Marys and James and Elizabeth. And over the last 50 years, there has been a revolution. Naming is wide open today, and there is no normal. We're seeing a lot more creativity with invention, with spellings. And what that's created is a situation where most of us don't like each other's names. There's a lot more baby name hostility out there because our choices are so diverse.
Baby name hostility. Define that.
There's name rage in the streets. People write into us raging against what their neighbors name their babies. Everyone wants to be different. That's the number one thing we all have in common, is we don't want to be anything like one another. The problem is that our tastes are just as similar as they ever were. So what you're seeing is a lot of tiny variations on a theme, the Aiden, Braden, Caden generation. In fact, today, a third of all American boys get a name ending in the letter N.
And it seems like a lot of girls get a name ending in the letter A. Hannah, Sophia, Isabella, on and on and on.
A has always been the top letter for girls' names, but today there's a feeling that you can put almost anything before it. Just put an A at the end and you have an acceptable name.
What about popular culture, movies, or sport?
Parents will take names wherever they find them. So you'll even see a destructive hurricane, which you would think would be a terrible association for a baby name, actually encourages the use of that name. All it takes is that pregnant woman to say, Katrina, you know, that's actually kind of a pretty name.
Really?
If the name is attractive, if it's a Camille or an Isabel instead of a Floyd, the name will rise.
That's so interesting. You know, it sounds like there's sometimes mysteries. I remember reading a story about a cohort of young people who were all named Gage, and no one could figure out what that was about. And it turned out that it had something to do with a secondary character on a popular American television series.
Today, Gage is part of another mini-name phenomenon, which is movies about demonic children. If you have a movie with a really cute tot who's possessed by the devil, that is a recipe for a fashionable name. Gage, Regan, Adrian, these all were spawned by horror movies.
You're kidding. I thought like maybe like a movie like Damien that parents would run in the other direction. Never want to name their kid that.
Damien is 100% the product of The Omen. Until then, almost no Americans chose that name.
Are there differences in terms of ethnic names? Is there sort of a blending or cross-blending, or are there sort of separate and parallel universes?
Well, parents are more willing to use ethnic names. There was a time when immigrant parents automatically chose an English name for their children to give them an advantage. Today, we're actually seeing second and third generation immigrants are turning back to their grandparents' homeland and choosing names from other cultures for their children.
And what happened to all of the names that used to be popular? Where did all the Bettys, the Mildreds, the Shirleys go, or for boys, the Homers, the Seymours? Why is no one named Prudence anymore?
We see about a 100-year cycle. What you're looking at is your great-grandparents' generation. So our own names are too ordinary, our parents are too boring, our grandparents sound old. But when you get back to your great-grandparents, you actually never were surrounded by those names, so they sound fresh again.
Laura Wattenberg, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's Laura Wattenberg. She's the author of The Baby Name Wizard. And you can see last year's most popular names and help one woman and her husband name their baby on NPR's Baby Project blog. That's at npr.org/babyproject. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. It's Independence Day. So today in our regular feature, Summer Sounds, we hear from a listener who has a special connection to the day's noisy ritual.
It's summertime.
My name is Beverly Dodge Brown, and I live in Georgetown, Texas. For me, growing up on the plains of southeastern South Dakota, summer was synonymous with the 4th of July. After all, my dad was the fireworks man. Every July 4th of my childhood, Dad planned and shot the Sioux Falls Municipal Fireworks Show at the football stadium. as the whole city cheered and gasped in awe. That made July 4th the biggest day of the year, the apogee of summer vacation toward which each day of summer inched, and the summit from which the remainder of vacation hurtled toward the start of school. Dad always started the show with a single report aerial shell salute, shot hundreds of feet into the air from a buried mortar, and exploding with a near-sonic boom. Next, a series of colored aerial bursts, each launched from a mortar with a forceful shoom. The crowd following its trail into the sky, holding its collective breath until the shells burst into luminous flowers. Mushrooming out symmetrically horizon to horizon. Then the multi-stage shells with multiple bursts, first green, then yellow, then blue, and always the final frame piece was the American flag, sizzling forth its red, white, and blue fire and smoke, and the mortar operators launched a final deafening volley of aerial salutes. Then startling silence. The field heavy with shifting layers of smoke. Summer had peaked in a thunderous, fiery spectacular. Its anticlimactic remainder stretched out lazily to dissipate amorphously like the crowd flowing out of the stadium, carrying cushions and coolers and memories of the magnificence of Dad's 4th of July fireworks show.
Beverly Dodge Brown, now of Georgetown, Texas, and her July 4th summer sound.
It's possible to be very successful in Hollywood without ever being invited to the Oscars, or any award ceremony for that matter.
Screenwriters Robert Ben Gurant and Thomas Lennon fall into this category, and they don't mind at all, because their movies have made an astonishing amount of money. Now, you might know them as the stars and creators of Comedy Central's police parody Reno 911.
As screenwriters, the pair have churned out big hits like Night at the Museum and also some big flops. Remember Taxi in 2004 with Jimmy Fallon? Chances are no. Now, Ben and Tom, as they're known, are out with a how-to book, Writing Movies for Fun and Profit, How We Made $1 Billion at the Box Office and You Can Do. Its chapters include rules like never take longer than 15 minutes to pitch a movie. And when they came into our studios here at NPR West, they certainly did talk fast. Their words tumbled over each other as the pair recalled one of their earliest pitches. It seems they were meeting with an executive at Universal, the studio located right next to its famous theme park.
Our first meeting in Los Angeles, we made a terrible mistake, which is we had a little bit of extra time and we were staying on the Universal lot and found a secret entrance into Universal Studios. We went on the Jurassic Park ride, didn't know it was a Flume ride, and we were in black suits.
Yes.
We came off of the ride soaking wet.
Soaking wet. And so we went
and then
into...
we walked into our first pitch with that, you know that sound your shoes make just very lightly? You're just a little bit moist, that kind
squish,
of...
Squish, squish, squish.
That was us.
They must have thought... What in the world?
And then the movie we were pitching was that Earth had run out of hops and we were sending a team to get beer.
They're making an intergalactic beer run.
Yes, beer intergalactic beer run was, yeah. Was the idea of the movie. So yeah. Here were these two wet guys in suits. I have no idea how we're still here.
One of the things that makes the book so funny is you point out on a regular basis how much your movies have made.
Mm.
Which is?
Renee, I believe, as the printing of the book, $1.4 billion.
And change.
Yeah, and change. And that's not DVDs.
No, no.
That's not like on
TV. That's people going
to the movie.
That's
box office.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, at some point, you have to understand, I go to the grocery store. And you know those movies that they sell at the grocery store?
Mm.
And you just think, oh, God, who wrote this? I've seen, at times, two of our movies next to each other at the grocery store.
Between
in the checkout
the
lane.
Inquirer and the Gum.
Next to Mints.
Yeah.
We're writing movies that people buy without thinking about it. So they're like, oh, yeah, I could use some Altoids and this movie with the talking bear.
That's some chapstick and, yeah, maybe that Jimmy Fallon vehicle that I heard wasn't that bad.
But that wouldn't have been... Taxi, would it?
Yes.
With Queen Latifah.
Queen Latifah. In fact, there's a chapter about Taxi in the book because, you know, you don't know when you're working on something that everyone's going to hate it
oh,
later.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Every movie, of course, goes through a testing process where they take it usually either to Long Beach, California, Northridge, or the Block at Orange, which are three giant malls.
Orange County.
Exactly.
Orange.
And they show it to an audience. And Taxi, people went bananas
people
for
loved
it. They
it.
Loved
people
it.
People loved it.
So we actually signed a contract to write Taxi 2.
So there's going to be a sequel, absolutely.
Of course.
For this hit movie, soon to be hit movie.
Soon to be hit movie, yeah.
Here's what we, and then suddenly, you know, before a tsunami happens, the tide goes way out to sea.
Yeah.
And in Hollywood, you can feel that happening.
Yeah.
When you have a movie that everyone hates.
The Monday before the Friday it comes out,
it
you can
so
sort
quiet.
Of, just, everything goes quiet.
Like, what happened?
And everybody gets nervous. Yeah.
And then
who's everybody?
The other producers.
Telltale signs that your movie's going to go bad is one is the producer of the movie flees the country. Actually, a brilliant man who produced that film and a good friend of ours, Robert Simons, called us as he was leaving for his plane to get out of the country. He said, guys, sometimes when you have a movie coming out like this, you're just going to be radioactive for a little while. So it's best just to lay low.
And we were really new to the studio system then. And so you think, okay, we're never, ever going to work
ever.
Again.
This is it.
And that's part of, we have another chapter about being fired gracefully and walking off of a failure gracefully.
Yes.
And you have to be willing to come right back in the next day and pitch something else. And you also have to be really nice to everybody. Because
by our count, there's really only about 75 or 80 influential people in Hollywood, and all they're doing is a musical chairs rotation all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are any number of tips that you give, general truths of making a success of it in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. One of them is don't be afraid to keep making the same movie over and over again, but not really.
But not really. What people need to embrace and accept if you're going to be a writer in Hollywood is that every single movie has the exact same structure, exactly. Whether it's Die Hard or Night at the Museum. Die Hard, the first 10 pages, you're introducing all of the facts. You're meeting the guy, you're getting him to the building, you get him stuck in the building. He's stuck in the building by terrorists. Night at the Museum, you meet a guy, he's having trouble with his marriage, and you get him stuck in a museum by the fact that he can't leave his kid and let his kid down and be unemployed
again. Seems like this guy's in over his head in a situation exactly like Die Hard.
It's a dinosaur instead of a terrorist, but the structure is exactly the same. And at the end, Larry Daly of Night at the Museum punches Dick Van Dyke off of a stagecoach instead of Die Hard, John McClane punching Hans Gruber off of a building. They're not similar. They're exactly the same. And if you pick Casablanca or The Matrix and turn to page 10, that's when he either gets the letters of transit from
Peter Lorre,
or that's when Trinity tells him, there is a matrix and you're inside it and you need to come with this or you're going to die. Yep. But the problem that a lot of young screenwriters have, and by that I mean baristas at Starbucks, is that they're struggling because they think formula is a bad word.
It's really not.
I think the writer is God is something that they kind of imply when they teach you screenwriting, and that's the opposite of the truth. The writer is a doormat.
No.
And I would say that for me a very inspirational way to learn that is if you buy the Blu-ray of Casablanca, there's a behind the scenes where they interview the teams of writers, and there are teams of writers who wrote Casablanca. And so that movie was theoretically a hot mess. They were rewriting it while they were shooting. Jack Warner fired tons and tons of people, and it's brilliant. Movies are a team effort. Like that's movies. We're not gazing out the window at the moor writing poetry. Mm-hmm. You're working for a living.
But by the way, you can do that once you've written some hit movies.
Oh yeah,
you can get a place on the moor. You can. It's fantastic. You can
and
get
that's when you
pounds.
Should write your poetry.
A castle. Mm-hmm.
Get a castle and write poetry. It's great.
Screenwriters Robert Ben Gurant and Thomas Lennon. Their new book is called Writing Movies for Fun and Profit, How We Made $1 Billion at the Box Office, and you can too. Thank you both very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
For our second All Tech Considered story today, we're going on a treasure hunt. And of course, like everything else, hunting for treasure has gone high tech. Its 21st century equivalent is called geocaching. And our guide on this hunt is Maine Public Radio's Jay Field.
Brad Wing and I barely shake hands before we're speeding south in his four-door Jeep Wrangler. A few hours ago, Wing got a message on his phone. Someone had just hidden a new geocache near a stream few miles south of Bangor, Maine. This treasure won't make anyone rich. For geocachers like Wing, it's all about the hunt.
I'm actually going to use my smartphone to get us down in the neighborhood because I haven't even loaded into my GPS.
Wing plugs a series of latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates into his phone. To play, cachers sign up for a membership on the sport's website, geocaching.com. That allows them to search for the coordinates of caches stashed all over the world.
I'll go out on a weekend, perhaps find 20 or 30 or 50 of them, and I've done as many as 140 in a day.
There are more than 5 million geocachers worldwide, stalking more than a million hidden caches. The sport draws in people of all ages, from older retirees geocaching their way across the country in RVs to fitness fanatics who hike, kayak, and climb mountains in search of caches. Geocaching took off in the spring of 2000, shortly after the government officially lifted the restrictions on civilian access to the same highly accurate satellite signals being used by the U.S. military.
The name of the cache is called the Old Trout Hole.
Wing checks his GPS device and turns onto a road leading into the woods.
It's at somebody's favorite fishing spot.
We stop by a stream in front of a culvert. Wing checks crevices between the rocks on one side of the stream. Nothing. Head across the road where finally we see it, hidden between two rocks. Wing unscrews the top of a green canister about the size of a pint of ice cream.
So we're going to open it up and look and see if there's a name on the log sheet yet. Oh, somebody's been here. Two people have been here today.
Most caches, says Wing, are small to medium-sized containers like this one, with a logbook inside and sometimes little doodads.
This one's got a couple of little trinkety things in. It's got a shell and a sticker.
Cachers are free to take what's inside on one condition.
You're supposed to replace it with something of kind of equal or greater value. You know, don't take out a toy truck and put in a rock.
Wing does have other hobbies. He likes to hike, camp, snowshoe, and kayak, activities that he admits frequently lead him back to geocaching.
I don't think I'm totally obsessed with it. Some may disagree, including my wife.
When they were first dating, Wing's wife didn't understand why he spent so much time stashing and searching for booty. That's a far cry from a sack of gold doubloons. But by the time they married, several years ago, Wing's wife had succumbed herself.
One of our other friends had placed a cache outside of the reception hall in a little micro cache out back. You look at some of the videos that were shot of our wedding and you see the bride, the groom, and half the reception flying out the back door. It does make for a real interesting conversation.
For the record, the bride and groom found the cache first. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Bangor, Maine.
One thing we know is that America is a nation of immigrants, of course. And one thing we also know that with all great holidays, a big part of celebration is the food. And it probably won't surprise you that many immigrant families celebrate America's Independence Day by incorporating cuisine from their home countries into the classic mix of hamburgers and potato salad. Throughout the program today, we are going to bring you personal stories from around the grill, many of which we found with a new American tradition, a social media shout out. First, we're going to hear from Megan Figueroa.
My grandparents are from Mexico, and they immigrated in the early 1900s to Bisbee, Arizona. And my dad was born in Bisbee, and he is Mexican-American, first generation. So traditionally, at our 4th of July table, in addition to the hamburgers and hot dogs, we will also have carne asada, pinto beans, tortillas, salsa, sometimes rice. And one of my favorite things that we have at our 4th of July table is Mexican corn on the cob, or what my dad refers to as elotes. He would spend a lot of time in Naco, Sonora, Mexico. And on the streets of Naco, there would be street vendors that would sell corn on the cob. And they would put cheese and hot sauce and lime and salt on these corn on the cob. For me, being Mexican-American is being American. I've known nothing different. And having corn with Mexican cheese and hot sauce and having pinto beans and having tortillas on 4th of July, it's as American as it comes.
That was Megan Figueroa. You can find her family recipe for Mexican elotes, along with all the other recipes we're sharing today, at npr.org. Click on Programs, then Tell Me More. Please stay with us for more ethnic influence on the 4th of July later in the program. Coming up, I Speak for Myself. That's the title of a new book that offers insights from 40 American women, Muslim women, who sometimes have to insist that they are American.
I wore a headscarf at a very young age, and the first question people usually asked me when I was in public was, "Where are you from?"
That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.